Back in the summer of 2016, I got my first job at 18 years old. I was excited about the work, but not about the commute. Without traffic, it was a 30-minute drive both ways, and I normally got off work around midnight, and the last thing I wanted to do was drive a half hour to get home. During the first few weeks, I was still getting used to my new routine, and one of the first things my mother told me was to keep an eye on my gas tank, and if I ever needed more, I should leave early and stop on the way, but never on my way back. I understood her concern. I was a petite 18-year-old female, and I looked even younger. But being who I was, I half forgot, half ignored that advice. And one night on my way home, I realized I legitimately didn't have enough gas in the tank to get me to my exit. I pulled into the first station I could find, not caring about the brand or the cost of the gas. I decided to make it as quick as possible, and only put in about $10 worth, just to get myself out of there. The station was empty, and there were sketchy-looking people walking up and down the sidewalk, in about 20 different angles where someone could sneak up on me. I swiped my card and began pumping gas, and once it got to the $10 mark, I shut it off and printed out my receipt. Thinking the worst was behind me, I was about to climb back into my car and book it home, when a voice came from the tiny intercom above the pump.
"Ma'am, there was a problem with your credit card payment."
I paused and glanced at the guy at the counter and felt a chill spiral down my neck. He was one of those tall, gaunt, sketchy-looking clerks, and was staring right out the window at me, beckoning me to come inside. I stepped back towards the gas pump and pressed the button on the intercom.
"What's wrong with my card? I have a receipt. It went through just fine."
I didn't try to hide the annoyance in my voice. I didn't like the look of this guy, or the way he sounded.
"I just need you to come inside, ma'am. Your receipt is incorrect. I'm going to need to run your card in here,"
he replied, a bit too quickly. I looked back at the guy through the window in frustration. There was no way I was going in there, where I would be alone with him. He was staring at me wide-eyed, like some kind of creep. I stood my ground, pulled out my phone, and checked my credit card app. I held it up stupidly as if he could see it from there, and I pressed the intercom button again.
"It went through. I see it on my statement. I'm not coming in."
"Ma'am, if you attempt to leave, I'll call the police. I have your tag number. Please come inside."
I then shouted at him from across the parking lot instead of pressing the intercom.
"Over $10 of gas, they're gonna call the cops? Fuck you. I'm leaving."
I walked a few steps around my car and gave him the finger. I was just about to walk back around my car and climb into the driver's seat when I paused. He was mouthing something to me through the window. I would have ignored it, but he suddenly looked much more desperate than creepy. He kept beckoning me forward and calling out something that I couldn't hear through the window. I must have made a weird look, because 5 seconds later he slammed a piece of paper on the window where he had hastily written, "Guy in your car." I turned back around and noticed that my passenger rear door was open to crack, which it had definitely not been on the drive from work. I booked it inside the station, and once I was there, the clerk locked the door and told me to get down. He had his eyes on my car and had a gun in his hand. I squatted down behind the counter and watched the security cameras as a tall guy in sweatpants and a windbreaker nudged my back door open, slid out quickly, and jogged away into the night. I started freaking out. Turns out the clerk had noticed the guy hanging around the side of the building on the monitors, and as soon as I pulled in, he made a beeline for my car. He crouched down and opened the door, and slid himself inside as I was swiping my card, being careful not to close the door all the way behind him, so that I wouldn't hear anything. The clerk had noticed all of this on the camera, and immediately called the cops, who arrived a few minutes later. They searched the area and my car, but were not able to locate the guy, or anything that would lead back to him. The gas station clerk probably saved my life, because who knows what would have happened if I had driven off with that stranger in the back seat. I think the lesson here is obvious. It's not enough to be cautious, you have to stay alert as well. Be suspicious, but not stupid. And always listen to your mom. Back in the spring of 1999, when I was 16, my family moved to a small mountain town in Colorado. I didn't mind the surrounding forests or the isolation at all, because I was already an outdoorsy type of person. I enjoyed hiking up hills and wandering down dirt paths. I quickly became friends with the only other kid my age who lived nearby. His name was Kyle. One evening, shortly before the start of summer, Kyle and I had been wandering through the woods and found a narrow river that flowed across the property. Being bored kids, our immediate reaction was to jump in and swim upstream and have fun. We kept at it until sundown. But instead of packing it in, set them down on the riverbank, and keep swimming. After maybe another 10 minutes, Kyle became very quiet and gestured for me to swim closer to him. When I was within arm's reach, he whispered to me, "Look over my shoulder, towards the tree line. I think someone is there pacing back and forth." I would have immediately dismissed his words as just him jumping at shadows, but the genuine concern in his voice made me pause. I glanced over to where he had indicated and scanned the tree line for a few wary seconds, but didn't notice anything moving. I said something to the effect of, "It's either an animal or just shadows, dude. No one has any business being on this property, and I doubt anyone else knows about this section of river." That didn't seem to put Kyle's mind at ease at all. He turned back around and looked towards the tree line again, and for a moment, there was complete silence. "Did you just hear that?" Kyle asked. I told him that I didn't hear anything. Kyle asked if I would walk up to the bank with him and investigate to see if there was anything there. I told him if we got out, we wouldn't want to go back in, and I kind of wanted to swim some more. Kyle didn't respond, but instead swam out towards the bank and climbed out of the water. I continued to swim like a moronic kid, oblivious to the notion that me diving forward into the water in the dark could have resulted in me caving my head in on a hidden rock or something. I'm not sure how much time passed before I suddenly began to feel very alone. I turned back towards the bank, and I didn't see Kyle anywhere. Both of the flashlights were still untouched, lying in the sand by our shoes. I called out for Kyle as I climbed out of the water, but he didn't seem to respond. I picked up my flashlight and scanned the trees with the beam. I called out for Kyle again, half convinced that he was just messing with me. But again, silence was the only response. I took a few careful steps into the woods, around the area that Kyle had pointed out earlier. I was getting ready to call his name out again when I noticed him. He was standing facing away from me, several yards away, staring deeper into the forest. I walked over to him, but he didn't turn towards me as I moved closer. I shouted something along the lines of, "Kyle, you jerk! Why aren't you answering me?" I reached out to grab his shoulder, but before I could, he slowly raised one hand and pointed a trembling finger towards the shadows. "Can you see that? What is that?" I shined the flashlight at his face. I could see that he was bone white, and his eyes were as wide as sewer covers. I barely noticed it at the time, but one detail I'll never be able to forget was a single droplet of blood running down from his nose. I turned the light in the direction that he was pointing and asked, "What?" It was like time had stopped. My flashlight beam caught a pair of legs and dark pants, and I felt my heart skip a beat. The flashlight felt extremely heavy in that moment, and if I were in any other circumstances, I would have snapped the beam light upwards immediately. But all I could do was slowly raise my arm, as if I was fighting gravity itself. The legs simply kept going, then the torso appeared. When my flashlight traveled all the way up past its chin, it had a very wide and gummy smile. It was the scariest face I had ever seen. I flipped my shit and dropped my flashlight. I collided with Kyle as I turned, and we both hit the ground. I screamed for him to run. Then I took off like a maniac back down the river and back at the path we had taken, abandoning everything else, including my friend. I lost count of how many times I tripped. It was at least 6, maybe as many as 10. But I continued to leap back to my feet and kept sprinting. using only the starlight through the overhead branches and the distant glow of indoor lights where my house was to navigate. I didn't say anything to Kyle. I was certain that I could hear him only a few steps behind me, crashing around the sticks just as loudly as I was. I shot through the garage door into the kitchen, screaming bloody murder. My arms and face were bruised and bloody, and at some point, I had lost one of my sneakers. But I barely registered that as I cried for my parents to call the police. I looked around behind me for Kyle, but he wasn't there. Assuming that he had run back to his own house, I asked my parents to call his parents after the police arrived. I was shaking so badly when the cops came, and they seemed concerned that I might have been overdosing on something. Then we got the phone call from Kyle's parents, and they were checking to see if Kyle had come home with me. And the police called in a team of dogs and extra men to scan the area. They located our belongings by the river, but they found no trace of Kyle or the stranger. The search lasted months, and over 100 miles worth of forest was searched, but no trace of him was ever found. To this day, Kyle has never been seen again. There was media coverage at the time, but given that we were in a small town where people get lost in the woods often, I don't know how far the story spread. What is probably the most heartbreaking is that Kyle's family is still without any answers. I live with the guilt of his disappearance every day. I doubt that I'll ever forgive myself for not stopping to make sure that he was behind me. To this day, I'm sure I can recall the sound of his footsteps behind me as I ran, so I don't know at what point he stopped, or if the thing grabbed him. Another thought has crossed my mind numerous times. What if it wasn't Kyle that I heard behind me? My partner and I work for the Sheriff's Department in a unit that specializes in ankle monitors and house arrests. Most of the time the job is very routine. You go and assign a device to the suspect in question, or you go to remove one, and occasionally you go to check to see if it has malfunctioned. It's not often that we have to ride out lights flashing to deal with someone who has breached their designated area. That's normally reserved for SWAT or local police. Those who try to make a run for it rarely get far, as their position is being monitored. There's only ever been one time that something happened that we couldn't handle or explain. I wrote a report about it, but my commanding officer handed it back to me and told me to rewrite it in a way that made sense, even if it's false information. I haven't spoken to anyone outside of my inner circle about the call, but I will share it here. People have to be aware that these types of things happen. We were assigned to a call to check on the status of an ankle monitor that had stopped broadcasting its signal. The last recorded spot was the house where the woman was supposed to be confined to, so we weren't really expecting any problems. We intended to go in and explain that we were there for a routine inspection. We didn't want to alert her to the fact that the monitor had stopped working. Upon our arrival, it was around 9 o'clock at night, and the house was at the end of a dark street corner, where there was absolutely no outside light. My partner took position behind the house in case anyone tried to leave out back, and I knocked on the door. The only light inside the house was coming from the living room directly by the front door, so I expected it would take a moment for someone to open it up. Surprisingly, it took nearly 3 minutes and several different sets of hard knocking before a middle-aged woman opened the door and peered out suspiciously at me. I knew that she wasn't the woman with the monitor. This was somebody else. I introduced myself and showed her my badge, and explained to her that we were there to inspect an ankle monitor. I apologized for the late hour of our visit, and asked if we could come in to speak to the person that we were looking for. The woman gave me a look like she was about to tear up in frustration, but she opened the door wider and whispered, "Come in, both of you. Help me find her." Her words caught me off guard because I hadn't mentioned to her that my partner was standing outside of the house. For a moment, I considered how she could have possibly noticed him, but I dismissed it and called over to my partner, and we both went inside. The house was an older-style colonial with a lot of high ceilings and wide hallways. The woman walked despondently back over to the living room and sat down in her chair. "I can't find her." She was speaking in such a quiet, dreamy way that I was suddenly concerned that she may have been sleepwalking. We performed a quick inspection of her eyes and asked to check her pulse, just to see if there was any signs that she was heavily medicated, but she appeared to be fine. I asked her repeatedly what she meant when she said that she couldn't find her, but she continued just to mutter the same thing over and over. I put a call into my radio stating that we may have a runner and to stand by. My partner and I left the living room and wandered in two separate directions down the hallway. The inside of the house felt very cold and drafty. For the life of me, I couldn't find a single light switch or lamp that would actually work, so only using my pen light, I navigated down the hallway and peered into the surrounding rooms. Here's where things start to become strange. Every time I stopped and entered a room, cleared it and returned to the hallway, I felt the sensation of being lost, like I had never set foot in that part of the house before. I tried to retrace my steps back to the living room, but I felt lost, dizzy, and confused. I started walking faster, picking up the pace, but after walking straight for about 15 seconds, I stopped. How long was this hallway? How deep was this house? I called out for my partner, but my voice sounded like it was reverberating in a very small space. I started to panic. Every time I turned a corner and peered into a room, it was like I was experiencing it for the first time. Each room had an assortment of different furniture, bookshelves, sewing tables, one had a bed, but I never seemed to find the same room twice. Even more alarming, I started to notice that I couldn't find any windows. I calmed myself down and forced myself to concentrate. I was worried that I was having a mental episode of some kind. I called the precinct on my radio, but it didn't even crackle. It just sat in my hand, cold and silent as a stone. I started calling out to my partner again. I took three left turns in a row, confident that I would find an outer wall with windows, but I just kept entering another hallway. Still no lights and no windows. I was now officially scared. This house was a standard two-story, four bedrooms. It was not supposed to be this big. I took a few careful steps forward. I stopped clearing rooms. At this point, I just wanted out, calling out to my partner even louder, not bothering to hide the panic in my voice. Suddenly, I turned another corner and found myself at the top of a staircase. At the very bottom, I saw the light of the living room, and the woman who had opened the door was sitting at the bottom of the steps, softly crying as she whispered over and over again that she couldn't find her. I remembered that I had never climbed any stairs, but somehow I had made it to the second floor. I practically dove down the stairs, and immediately my radio crackled back to life. Finally, I had the sensation of normalcy again. I rested my hands on my knees and gasped for breath. I called out to my partner, and after a few minutes he appeared at the top of the stairs as well. His face was pale, his eyes were huge, and he stared down at me in horrified amazement. "How did I get up here?" he asked me, quickly descending the stairs. "I can't find her," the woman cried out. My partner and I left immediately without saying anything more to the woman. Once outside, we checked our watches. I asked my partner how long we had been in there, and he replied it was about 15 minutes. It was just after 10. In an hour's time, we had failed to clear a two-story house because we both had gotten lost. "I never climbed any stairs. I was just following your voice. I was completely lost." We radioed into our precinct with a report that the suspect was not in the house. They then put out an APB. We returned to the station to file our report, and our CO gave us grief about not questioning the woman on site and leaving the scene. We filed our reports, he reviewed it, and then made us rewrite it. The following morning, we were able to go back and search the house again during the daylight. This time it took us 5 minutes to clear the entire house, and nothing strange happened at all. The house seemed perfectly ordinary, but the images of some of the rooms I encountered the previous night bounced around in my head. There had been a room with a particular wall clock, another with a desk that had a globe on it, and another with a dusty chandelier that I couldn't find anywhere inside the house after I searched it in the daylight. It should go without saying that there was no way to the second floor except by using that one staircase. To the best of my knowledge, the female suspect was never found. I had to fill out a second report clarifying the possible way she could have fooled our system and escaped the house. The thing is, Part of me thinks she never escaped. She still may be there, wandering the endless dark hallways, trying to find her way back to reality.